minutes Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll get some inspiration from Creole cooking with Chef Ace Champion from Green Bay. First, federal lawmakers reintroduced the Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act this week. It's a package of bills that takes aim at the black maternal death crisis in the U.S. Wisconsin has the highest black infant mortality rate in the United States, and our state's pregnancy-related maternal mortality rate is five times higher for black women than it is for white women. Gwen Moore is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 4th District, which includes parts of the Milwaukee metro region. She introduced part of the Momnibus legislative package. I talked to her earlier today. Representative Moore, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I enjoy your program. Good talking to you again.
Thanks. Well, now you introduced a bill that's part of this broader Momnibus package focused on the health workforce, the perinatal health workforce. What kind of things are you hoping to accomplish here?
Listen, thanks for asking. This Perinatal Workforce Act really is something that really has evolved out of my own lived experience. As a mother of three, grandmother of three, great-grandmother of two, I've experienced pregnancy as a black woman, and it has really navigated some of the need to provide more professional care so that we can reduce the maternal deaths and bad outcomes from pregnancy. As you might know, we've talked about this before, Rob, that black women, brown women, certainly Native American women, are 3 to 5 times more likely to experience death or disability during pregnancy than other women. And it's not because there's some sort of black gene that's warped, but it's because of the sort of the institutional racism, neglect, cultural incompetence, and women falling through the cracks. And I think in my own experience really demonstrates that. You know, I had my first baby at age 18, and it was such a traumatic experience for me, Rob. I really didn't have that. I had my other two children at home. I went into the hospital at age 18. They separated me from my adult sister. It was New Year's Day, the wee hours of New Year's Day. I mean, every male intern in that hospital came in to examine me. In what I regarded as a compromised position. I even knew then that something was really inappropriate about this train of men examining me, and then one even opining that it wasn't that bad after I just sort of cried out from the pain of being in labor. So I went on to have that child, but it was really important to me to have the visiting nurse come and visit me after I had the baby. She taught me how to put a pin in a baby's diaper. I mean, I did not know how to do that. Fast forward, my daughter gave birth to my first granddaughter at 1 pound, 2 ounces. We needed lactating specialists to work with us to help her produce the milk for this 1 pound, 2 ounce baby. We have some at-risk pregnancies. Unfortunately, Milwaukee is one of the places where we have very young mothers. So you take a 15 or 16-year-old, and it may not have the kinds of, they may be at risk. I live very close in my neighborhood to a place, you know, where girls who are in trouble or break down in their family relations live. Those are pregnant women who would benefit, we think, a great deal from having a doula, someone to advocate for them, make interventions, make sure they're having the right diet, that they're getting to the doctor's appointments. And we actually have a doula program in Milwaukee that is really, really demonstrating itself to have really good outcomes. And so we're, even the physician's assistant, my daughter had her second child, and it was a physician's assistant who carefully scoured her record and prevented the physician who was all scrubbing up, getting ready for a vaginal birth, to say, no, here in the record, we've got to do another C-section. And so I have really, from my own learned experience, come to recognize the broad array of professionals that are missing between, you know, that person who might give you a pregnancy test and the person who's there in the delivery room for you to give birth, and how we might be able to mitigate some of the tragic outcomes of pregnancy for Black and Brown women with a perinatal workforce. And, you know, go on.
What would your legislation do to kind of make sure that those professionals are there, they have the training, and they have the sympathy for the patients that need their help?
You know what? This is a really good thing. We have the science and research that really show that racism, sexism, and access to quality health care compromises Black women's health. And we hope that that's a compelling enough to draw people into this workforce and to get them to be interested. But they also have to have training, certification. And we have to have, and my Mama's First bill would provide Medicaid. We talked about this before, access to Medicaid and payment for these professionals. So I want them to have education, training, best practices, and to be able to be reimbursed. What if the insurance company were to reimburse, say, an at-risk 16-year-old who's pregnant for a doula, you know, that older woman who is there to make sure that they keep up with their doctor's appointments, that they're there to advocate for them so they're not ignored. I remember about a year after I graduated from high school, there was a girlfriend of mine who went to the hospital with pain, complaining of pain, and they sent her home with the old take a couple of Tylenol routine, and she ended up having an ectopic pregnancy and dying. Somebody who, I mean, sort of typical of people being ignored, people, a Black woman's pain not being acknowledged and recognized. You know, what if, you know, you're in that situation and you have a doula, you know, and somebody says, look, you sent her home, but the pain is agonizing. We're coming back. And make them respond. Because right now, I feel sorry for our overburdened healthcare system. I mean, right now we have a healthcare system. I hear they're putting people in the gift shop because of COVID. There have been surgeries for other maladies that have been postponed because of COVID predominating. Imagine how pregnancy could get crowded out as an issue for people to be concerned with. Imagine, I think about all the moms and the risks that they've taken giving birth during COVID and going to a hospital for that to happen. And then we have healthcare professionals that are specializing. We've got a whole group of geriatrics coming on board. People have other specialties. And we don't want there to be a drain of talent that doesn't look at getting good maternal and child outcomes because they're attracted to other fields where they can get the pay that they deserve. We think that women's health, and then this is such a startling different outcome for Black and Brown women. And so we think it's really important to be able to attract people to this workforce.
As we wrap up, again, this is one piece of a larger package. This package had been introduced before. Are you hopeful that that something's going to get passed this time around, given everything else that's going on in Congress right now?
Hallelujah! We've got a new sheriff in town. We've got a president, and you know, for all of the stuff that, first of all, let me just talk about the vice president, Kamala Harris. When she was a senator, she was the original Senate sponsor of the Momnibus. So Cory Booker now has picked up her legislation this cycle, but she's the original sponsor. So her eyes are not going to glaze over. We don't think her eyes are going to glaze over when she sees our package come up. And we also think that Joe Biden himself, just having been a single parent, has a lot more empathy for these issues than past presidents. Just the well-being of moms and kids, and we are excited about the opportunity.
Representative Moore, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Gwen Moore is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin. She talked with us about a package of bills to fix racial health disparities for pregnant women. Next, we'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about efforts to improve black maternal outcomes here in the state. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about racial disparities and maternal health outcomes and efforts to turn the tide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can better help black moms and their newborns? Is this something you've experienced yourself? If you are a woman of color, you've given birth here in Wisconsin. Have you had trouble getting good treatment? If you work in healthcare, what have you seen? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Tiffany Green is an economist and teaches in the departments of population health sciences and obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard from Representative Moore, both with her legislation and her personal experiences. Can you tell us more about the sort of disparities we see here in Wisconsin for moms of color, black moms in particular?
For black moms in particular, you see patterns amplified that you see across the rest of the United States. You already stated before that Wisconsin has the highest black infant mortality rates in the United States. And while our maternal mortality ratios are lower in absolute terms, the magnitude of the gap is wider here in Wisconsin when it comes to black-white maternal mortality.
I guess a big question would be why. I mean, it's bad around the country. Why particularly bad here in Wisconsin?
I think that people have a lot of speculation. I don't know that I would say that this has been empirically established, but Wisconsin is characterized by quite a bit of inequality when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to high black male incarceration rates. That system of inequality contributes likely to adverse birth outcomes.
You've been involved in efforts to tackle this problem in Wisconsin and in particular in Dane County, where you're based, of course, as a researcher. What kind of things do we see in the state that are trying to turn things around here?
Well, I guess I will be a little biased and put forth the Black Maternal and Child Health Alliance that was founded just a few months ago to bring a coalition of Black women working in organizations across Dane County to support Black birthing people and their families. And I think this work is really important because we are addressing some of the structural issues, whether it comes to coordinated care. We are working on building a portal where Dane County citizens and citizens across the state and country can view some of the disparities with the hope of using those data to turn things around. And we also have an arm of the Black Maternal and Child Health Alliance that is addressing the needs in the most resource-deprived neighborhoods in Dane County with an effort to redirect resources towards those neighborhoods and residents in order to improve the lives of Black families that live in those places.
We heard from Representative Moore sharing her personal experiences there, giving birth and feeling like healthcare staff, some of them not taking her seriously, not listening to her concerns. Same for her children and grandchildren. And when you start to dig into this issue, these are stories, it seems like, you hear again and again from Black women in the healthcare system. Is this something you see out there? And if so, what can we do to, I don't know, bridge those gaps?
So yes, this is pretty common. I think the world learned more about this when Serena Williams talked about her birth experience. She is a world-class athlete that knows her body and knew that she was having a pulmonary embolism. And her nurse basically told her, hey, you're confused from pain medication. Serena Williams. And as it turns out, she did have this disorder. And that really marked a cascade of issues after she was diagnosed with that pulmonary embolism. And I think that we don't have a lot of data, but we see from qualitative studies and even some quantitative studies that Black women are less likely to be listened to in care. And this includes perinatal health care. What can we do about it? You know, it's a challenge. And I think one, making sure that they have high quality care where providers are listening to them. And if the providers cannot provide that care, then they don't need to be seeing birthing people.
We're talking to Tiffany Green from UW-Madison at the Department of Population Health Sciences, an economist there, and she works with the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology as well. We're talking about efforts to close racial gaps when it comes to health outcomes for new moms and their kids. Big racial gaps around the country, including maybe especially here in Wisconsin. You could join in with your thoughts, questions, and experiences at 800-642-1234. Tiffany, we talked to Representative Moore about this big piece of legislation in Congress. We focused in on a piece of it that she had sponsored. As you look at what they're calling the momnibus here, what stands out to you that might be particularly helpful?
So, you know, I think that the momnibus does something really important. It's addressing not just medical care, but the social determinants of health, which are likely far more important, including housing, including education. All those things matter when it comes to birth outcomes. And I think they've had to do that because we have eroded the social safety net, right? And so I think those may be an important start to helping improve outcomes by giving people the things that they need to thrive and survive. You can't have a healthy and uncomplicated pregnancy if you're worried about housing. And you can see in the Saving Our Babies report that the Foundation for Black Women's Wellness did a couple of years ago, where women talk about having challenges with housing in Dane County, having antagonistic relationships with landlords that take advantage of them. And so those things matter when it comes to stress. And although we don't know the etiology of most preterm birth, we have a pretty strong feeling that it is related to stress. And I think by eliminating, you know, the worry about these very basic needs, that might go a long way towards helping to get us to the right path.
I've been talking to, I think, a lot of public health people, Tiffany, and some policymakers over the last few years, trying to draw that line between social conditions, economic conditions, things like housing, food availability, quality of life, things like that, drawing a straight line from that to health and health outcomes. Do you see this as something that's getting taken more seriously now by policymakers, by people who vote on decisions that'll affect these things?
I think people are taking it seriously. The challenge is, and this might be a little bit unpopular to say, that often the right solutions don't align really well with election cycles, right? These are things that are going to take a very long time to implement and to see the results of. But I think that I'm glad to see politicians investing in these long-term solutions to help improve these outcomes.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, in light of these mortality rates for young minority babies or pregnant women, I understand that there will be people that are appealing for changes in the system, but why don't whole communities look at this and say, this is horrible, fix it?
Thanks for the call. Tiffany, do you see communities starting to raise these concerns?
So what I will say is that there have been communities working on these issues for a very long time. In Madison in particular, the elders such as Betty Banks and Hershey Barnett were doing this work for a very long time through Harambe Village before the city of Madison closed it down. So they have been, they and others like them have been doing this work for decades, but it's only now that people have been paying attention, to be quite frank. And so I am heartened by some of the concern that people are showing now. But remember that even if we don't know that people are working on these issues, there have been Black women in this community in particular working on this stuff for a very long time when, frankly, people didn't care.
Thanks for the call. And Tiffany, we focused with the statistics on deaths, women dying during their pregnancies, children dying shortly after being born. There are other outcomes, I imagine, that are going to stick around for life. Bad health outcomes for moms and their newborns that can last for years. Is that part of what we're focusing on here, too?
I think that's important. While you know, the rise of social media has really brought these maternal deaths into relief in ways that we haven't seen before, I think maternal deaths are a devastating but actually pretty rare outcome. It's maternal morbidity that we also need to be concerned about, things like hemorrhaging, cardiovascular events that are the canary in the coal mine for maternal mortality. And thus, it's critical that we address the social determinants of these to prevent them in the first place, and also make sure that women receive and birthing people receive coverage past that standard, that short time in which you get kicked off of Medicaid, right? So a lot of these cardiovascular events, a lot of things that lead to mortality last beyond 42 days, which is our standard measure of maternal mortality. Right. So it's really very important that we, as you say, think about these issues in terms of low birth weight and preterm birth. The United States, we're actually very good at saving tiny babies. But those tiny babies that are born often have a number of health and developmental outcomes that are very expensive. And it's important to make sure that they have the support that they need to thrive.
We'll leave it there for now. Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tiffany Green is an economist and teaches in the Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. She talked to us about health obstacles that Black mothers and infants currently face and how to improve those outcomes. We also heard from Wisconsin Congressional Representative Gwen Moore, who's sponsoring part of a big piece of legislation on that issue. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Mardi Gras is next week, and we're learning from Green Bay chef Ace Champion, who specializes in Creole and Cajun cooking. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, it's tax season. Get some advice and answers to your questions from a personal finance expert. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Monday morning, excuse me, at 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, Mardi Gras is next week, a holiday meant to be celebrated with food. It's Food Friday, and we're getting some inspiration from the world of Creole cooking. Sounds pretty good in a cold Wisconsin week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a dish you make every year this time of year, maybe inspired by Mardi Gras? Do you have a favorite Fat Tuesday culinary tradition? Have you eaten a lot of Louisiana-style food? What's your favorite? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ace Champion is from Louisiana, now a Green Bay-based chef and cooking instructor who specializes in Cajun and Creole cooking. He's host of the TV show Cook Like a Champion and author of the books 8 Steps to Your Perfect Meal and Cook Like a Champion, Cooking with Ace. Ace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I was watching some of your show, digging through your recipes. What I love sometimes, Ace, is you take that Cajun and Creole cuisine and you merge in a little Wisconsin. Some Wisconsin cheese finds its way into your po' boys and things like that. How have you tried to merge your two home states?
Oh, you got to, man. It's not all about where you're from. It's where you're at, too.
And how has your cooking evolved in the years since you started in Louisiana?
It's been great. You know, I came up here around 2002, specifically to bring Cajun Creole out here to Wisconsin. And, you know, I'm down here in Green Bay and they've accepted it very well. You know, I'm doing the private in-home cooking and then teaching cooking classes.
Now, Parley, we called you because Mardi Gras is coming up next week. What kind of things are usually on your menu this time of year?
Oh, well, right now, everyone seems to be ordering the same menu. I almost forgot it was Fat Tuesday. That's why they were doing that. But, you know, a lot of French Quarter, seafood gumbo, sausage, jambalaya, you know, was on the menu. I got a private dinner tonight. They're doing the New Orleans Hush Puppies with, of course, the Wisconsin cheese addition to that. You know, and then you can't never have enough of those good old red beans and rice and maybe a little bananas Foster's for dessert.
Now, you've got a spice mix that's one of your favorites to work with. And I saw some people reviewing it saying, you know, it's got flavor, it's got some spice, but it's not too hot. And I think sometimes people think Cajun and Creole, oh, it's going to be super hot. It doesn't have to be, does it?
This is so true. This is so true. And this is kind of what took me a while to kind of, you know, get my business going is that misconsumption right there. It's like, man, I can make shrimp etouffee with no Cajun season. You know, it's just the amount of season that you add. Now, if you go down to New Orleans, they do put extra cayenne in there. They make it extra hot because that's how they like it. But as a chef here in Wisconsin, I know that's never going to fly. So it's more of a milder, all natural Cajun season that you can find on my website. And then here locally, we also sell it at Season to Taste down here in Howard too as well. And Apocryphy too. So we're trying to get it out there in the hands of my fellow Wisconsinites.
What are some of the key flavors and spices that make it into, you know, a lot of our Cajun and Creole food? I know they'll vary from one dish to another.
Oh yeah, I mean the number one differential is the Cajun, the cayenne pepper. You know that, you know, in Jamaican they got the Scotch bonnet. You know, we got the cayenne pepper. You know, there's a lot of paprika. There's a lot of herbs in there, and that's why I love the Cajun season, because I mean you're looking at like 9 to 12 different herbs and spices in there. So it kind of takes out the guessing work when you're in the kitchen trying to figure out what spices to use. You just go right to the champion Cajun season, and you're good to go.
We're talking to Ace Champion, Green Bay-based chef and cooking instructor. You can see him on the TV show Cook Like a Champion. It's Food Friday. He's got some Cajun and Creole-inspired advice for us to cook at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite food maybe you remember from a trip to New Orleans? Do you want to know how to make it at home? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ace, you shared some recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm not usually a guy who's going to start a meal with dessert, but I'm going to do it this time. Okay, here's the recipe. Chocolate bread pudding with whiskey butterscotch cream sauce. You had me at chocolate bread pudding with whiskey butterscotch cream sauce. I love bread pudding, and these variations sound so awesome. Tell us about this guy.
Yeah, you know, the best way I can describe it, you know, is basically it's if you were making French toast using French bread, soaking the French bread in that nice rich custard and then baking that off. The sauce, traditionally in New Orleans, you would have the hard sauce, which is kind of like the caramel sauce, which that works great too as well. But a few years back, I started just doing a basic whiskey cream sauce that I got from Emeril Lagasse, which is basically heavy whipping cream, a little bit of milk, some sugar, and thicken up with slurry. But that kind of reminded me of my college days as one of the mother sauces. So I was like, okay, well, if I put raspberries in there, I can have now a raspberry whiskey cream sauce. So when I did this chocolate version, I knew as a kid, butterscotch was like the forgotten candy that my grandma used to always give me in church. So the mixture of that butterscotch, and I'm just using butterscotch morsel chips that I'm throwing into the whiskey sauce right before it's done. And that literally puts it on a whole nother level.
And this sounds like, from what you were just saying, you can play with a lot of variations on this. You mentioned there's raspberries. Your recipe says you've got a lot of options for the whiskey. Tell us a couple of ways we could shake this one up if we're not happy with it as is,
oh,
which I am.
Oh, yeah. You know, hey, you know, we're from Wisconsin, so we love the Door County cherries. So there's a Door County cherry version of that. You know, hey, you don't like white or dark chocolate. I like white chocolate. You could add that to that. You could definitely add any kind of nuts. Pecans are excellent. Almonds are excellent. And like I say, just think of this as a base. You know, you literally could, you can add apple pie filling and make an apple pie bread pudding, you know. And then like that sauce that we're making, that's not just for bread pudding. I mean, that sauce is, I mean, you can make waffles, French toast. I mean, you name it. That sauce is good for. Don't even put it on dessert. Just put it in your coffee if you have any leftovers and you got something good.
That sounds
good. Oh, yeah.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Duluth. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, well, Kevin?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, first off, don't be afraid of making things a little hotter than you do.
I hear you.
Because there's some people up here that like that and can easily handle it and are looking for it. But at any rate, I just wanted to ask you about sassafras, the use of sassafras. I found it to be, in the past, to be a real critical component to certain things when I make Cajun, Creole, Cuban kinds of things. And I love it, but then I hear that there's a potential carcinogenic aspect to it, and I wondered how big of a concern that is. If you use it, if you don't, what is a viable substitute to get that particular richness that it seems to provide?
You talking about like the gumbo filet?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, what they call that. Yeah, and that's just ground saffron. You're right. You know, it's being in Wisconsin, you know, it's not that easy to find a lot of those ingredients. So I've made this recipe gumbo several times, and I just didn't add it to it, you know. And there's certain things that I want to add, like okra, for instance. You know, that's a staple, but I kind of refuse to use frozen okra, you know, until I can find some fresh okra in here in Green Bay. I just don't put it in there. You know, really the good gumbo that's really going to make it stand out is that dark roux that you do. And, you know, just making sure you got a good broth too as well. So boil them bones and get a nice rich broth.
So thanks for the call, Kevin. So you make do in some cases. I have learned to really like okra in my adult life, but yeah, it's, you know, it's not in season that much here in Wisconsin. It's not all over the place. When it is, right, do you make as much use of it as you can, Ace?
Oh yeah. You know, and when some people feel like, you know, they have to have a substitution, you know, like there was one recipe, I was doing a vegan bread pudding and I didn't want to use applesauce instead of egg. So I just didn't put the eggs in it, and it wasn't as, you know, vibrant, but as far as flavor wise, it was just as good. So a lot of times if you leave out, you know, obviously it can't be the main ingredient, like don't leave out the Cajun seasoning, but you know, if it's just like a gumbo filet is like a finishing technique, you know, if you leave it out, I mean, I think you'll be just fine.
It's Food Friday. Ace Champion is with us, Green Bay-based chef and cooking instructor, originally from Louisiana. He specializes in Cajun and Creole cooking. He's giving us some inspiration from Louisiana cuisine. He's got some recipes, by the way. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll get some more of them coming up. And you could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Cajun or Creole cooking? Do you have a Mardi Gras recipe to share, or you're looking for something to add a little spice to a cold Wisconsin week next week? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Chef Ace Champion. He teaches classes in Creole cooking. He's getting us set up for Mardi Gras next week. His books include Cook Like a Champion, Cooking with Ace. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dish for the Cajun and Creole cuisine world? Do you have something you tried, maybe at a restaurant, maybe on a trip to Louisiana? You want to find out how to recreate it as best you can? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Find a few recipes that Ace shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls now. Leighton is with us in West Bend. Leighton, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to ask about, Leighton?
Oh, catfish couillon.
What was that?
Catfish couillon?
Catfish couillon.
Couillon. Yep. Is that something you, I'm not familiar with that, Ace.
Is that kind of like, you talking about like fried catfish with some type of sauce over it?
Correct.
Oh yeah. So what do you want to know about it?
I was just wondering if you had a recipe and.
Oh yeah. So basically what that is, you know, if you have a cream sauce recipe, so, you know, like an Alfredo sauce recipe, what I do is I'll use like sherry wine instead of traditional Chardonnay. And you can get crawfish tail meat, I believe, at like Walmart or somewhere. So you basically make the Alfredo sauce with the wine. You add your Cajun seasonings in there. And I like to do a ratio mixio. I never just use cream. So I'll use like maybe a cup of cream and to a cup of wine and to a cup of chicken broth, you know, and that'll give it a really nice flavor. And then just fry up your catfish, your normal, you know, use your Cajun season, you know, your 50-50 ratio with the flour and the cornmeal. And then once that catfish is done, you know, you're just going to put that on your plate and you just spoonful that sauce right over it. It's excellent. Cream sauce and fried fish is, oh my God, you talk about delicious. We also do that in a pastry too as well. We'll stuff a pastry with jambalaya and put that same type of crawfish cream sauce over that.
Sounds fantastic. Thanks for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Ace, I want to check out another recipe you shared with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, this is a Creole crab dip, but hold on. It's a hot green and yellow three cheese Creole crab dip. Green and yellow. Where'd you come up with that?
I don't know. A couple of, you know, all-star NFL team out here in Wisconsin.
Those guys.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I always love to be festive. You know, traditional in Louisiana, you know, they would just use maybe a cheddar cheese or something. But, you know, being in Wisconsin, I like to put, I mean, now I put up to 8 different cheeses. I use that 5 cheese Italian blend, and then I'll use like a pepper jack or a Kobe jack. So specialty cheeses work excellent in this dish. And it can be made ahead of time. I literally prep up the dish. I love putting it in a pie plate. That's my best bet. You know, wrap it up, and then the next day when your guests are coming, throw it in the oven for about 15-20 minutes, and you're good to go. You know, the pita chips that are on there, they take a little time. They're a little tedious, but if you've never had homemade pita chips, and that's just using the actual pita bread, oh, man, they're like night and day compared to what you would buy from the grocery store.
This sounds like an awesome snack. Again, those are both up, the pita chips and the hot green and yellow three-cheese Creole crab dip from Ace Champion, up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Wausau. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mike?
Hey, well, I've been down to New Orleans a few times, and one of my favorite dishes is barbecue shrimp. There's one at Deanie's restaurant. They serve it's my favorite, and I've tried to make it at home, but it is never even close.
Well, the problem is we're you're getting your seafood down there from the Gulf of Mexico, and we're getting ours down here from where you know, somewhere overseas, China, Vietnam. I'm not sure, but I know it's not coming from the Gulf. So, you know, if you can start off with a good quality, you know, seafood, that really is hands down. I know at a couple of local grocery stores like Festival, when you buy the shrimp, just look for Gulf shrimp and make sure that they have the whole shell on it. You don't want them peeled or deveined. Otherwise, too much of the liquid gets into the shrimp. So just whole shrimp, nothing done to that. And then good quality Gulf shrimp. And then find a good shrimp boil. There's tons of them on, you know, on the shelf. There's Zataran, Slap Your Mom, a couple different ones. Get a nice shrimp boil. And you should be good to go. And when you do the shrimp boil, I would recommend maybe adding some sausage to that too as well, because that sausage is going to release that fat in there and give the shrimp a little extra flavor too as well.
Fantastic. Hope that helps you out, Mike. That sounds really good. Yeah, we had another listener email. Grant emailed the shrimp he finds isn't doing the job for him. Grant was wondering, you know, if we're just not able to find shrimp we want, can we do like Creole dishes with other types of seafood that maybe we can get better quality here?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, the knockoff to the shrimp in Louisiana is the crawfish, and you can get that frozen. I know I picked some up at Walmart the other day, and it was actually from Louisiana. Sea scallops tend to hold well. You know, I always say just use your own fish. I mean, if you have a good catfish recipe and you love, you know, what is it, perch out here or haddock, you know, you can use those fishes. You know, it's just catfish is so predominant in Louisiana. That's why they use it. So feel free to splurge. And I've noticed a lot of times where they call for seafood, I've done a shrimp etouffee where someone didn't like seafood. So I substituted chicken, and there's no recipe for chicken etouffee, but it actually came out great.
Awesome. Thanks for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ace Champion. He's from Louisiana originally, now a Green Bay-based chef and cooking instructor, host of the TV show Cook Like a Champion. He's got some Cajun and Creole dishes to get us ready for Mardi Gras and get us through a cold stretch of winter. Well, now this, the other recipe we've got up from you at WPR.org/Food Friday sounds like a great meal for a cold, cold night. Beef and bourbon pot roast with mushroom port wine sauce. How do we get this roast going?
I almost called that shut the front door pot roast. You know, no, so I created that. I teach cooking classes down here at Mona Rose Winery, and she requested me, and I kid you not, I've never had made pot roast. So I said, I can't just make pot roast the way grandma's done, and I'm not going to go up against no grandma. So I had to twist it up. So what I did is you roast the pot roast in the oven about 250 for about three and a half hours by itself. And by this way, you allow the roast to just take on the flavor and release the flavors into the juices. Now, the carrots, I learned that brown sugar carrots actually go good with pot roast because it kind of clashes the sweet and the spicy. So I make these carrots, you know, you just get the sliced carrots from the store, saute them with a little bit of butter, a little bit of sugar, make sure they're still al dente and crunchy, and then put those to the side. And then the potatoes, I got the really small baby red potatoes that I just steamed and baked off in the oven. So when I serve this pot roast, I have the pot roast, I have the carrots on the side, and the potatoes on the side. And instead of just having the gravy where carrots and the bro, everything's all mixed in together, so you just experience one flavor, I had did this mushroom port wine sauce that actually is meant to go over pork tenderloin. I made that from the leftover pan juices of the roast. So when the roast was done, I poured it over it as a sauce. And this way, you don't have a plate where there's pot roast and everything all over the plate, and it's all just one big plate.
Now, I want to take
you can enjoy the flavors individually by themselves.
It sounds awesome. And again, that's up at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to ask about one more dish I saw. We don't have it up on the website here. You enter contests sometimes. You had, I read this, a bacon mac and cheese, grilled cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
It's got everything.
Yeah, so I'm a fierce competitor, you know, and I went up, and I didn't know it was this serious, and we went up to Dodgeville and competed in the National Grilled Cheese Champion. I think there was 52 creameries and over 110 people competing, and we ended up taking 3 out of 4 awards. So this mac and cheese recipe is basically you make the queso sauce, which is cheese, a little bit of vodka, some heavy whipping cream, and instead of using elbow noodles, I use rigatoni. So the cheese actually gets in there. So you toss the noodles in this cheese sauce. I laid them on parchment paper, put them in the refrigerator so the cheese kind of hardened up. Then for the bread, I made like this Creole Italian infused butter to go on a kind of like a honey, really wholesome bread. And then I topped that with a new specialty salsa jack cheese. And then I grilled that off. So you have the actual just melted cheese, you have the cheese sauce in there, and then you have the rigatoni noodles. I mean, I ate it, and it's almost like you don't even know you're not eating meat. It's a heavy sandwich. It probably weighs about, 12 to 14 ounces, but let me tell you, it's good eating.
In our last few moments, Ace, you spent a lot of time teaching people to cook, cooking for other people. When it's just you, what do you like to make for yourself, just in our last half minute or so?
I am not a picky guy. I mean, when it comes to myself, I mean, I might just make me a burger. I mean, I'm not like, and people are always so afraid to cook for me because they think I'm going to be that guy that's like, oh no, I'll eat your spaghetti out of the can. I'll eat your hamburger helper. I am not a picky eater. I just cook the way I cook because I that's my job. I get paid to do that, but just all around, I just love to cook, it's not really the physical cooking part of it. It's what cooking brings, being able to, like tonight I'm going in doing a birthday party, and see all these family members coming together around the table and enjoying good food and music and just having a blast and knowing that I did that. That really allows me to live my purpose and not just, it's not all about just filling up your belly. There's a lot more Excellent. That comes with cooking good food.
Ace, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Ace Champion, Green Bay-based chef and cooking instructor who specializes in Cajun and Creole cooking. His books include Cook Like a Champion, and you could see him on the TV show Cook Like a Champion. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll look at the aftermath of the impeachment trial. That and a lot more coming up Monday here on Central Time. If you're not on the internet much, that's probably okay. But sometimes you might miss some good stuff. Not to worry, I am here to help you find these things. Like this list that's been making the rounds, a list of birds with names that seem insulting to those birds. Twitter user Stu Royal wrote, "My favorite species of birds are the ones named by people who clearly hate birds." He then went on to share some of their names and pictures. "I have verified that all of the following are actual names of birds of the world, sometimes commonly accepted around the English-speaking world. Sometimes these names are just in regional usage." Here we go with some of them. Drab seed eater. That's boring. Perplexing scrub wren. The sad flycatcher. The rough-faced shag. Can I say that? There are some that I probably shouldn't say on the radio. Here's one. Go away, bird. Or go away, bird. I don't know how you're supposed to say it. Then smew. S-M-E-W. Smew. This one sounds sinister. Satanic nightjar. There's the monotonous lark and the horned screamer. Now, I'm not very good with birds. I appreciate bird names that just sound like what the bird looks like red-winged blackbird. What's that bird? It's black. It's got red wings. Red-winged blackbird. I'm all for simplicity. Share your favorite bird name, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.